KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the inaugural show for this quarter of Hearsay Culture. I hope everyone had a good holiday season, and I'm excited to be back and having great discussions with great guests this quarter. We're going to start off our discussions this quarter with a guest that I'm very excited to have on, Professor Tarleton Gillespie of my alma mater, Cornell University, the author of a book that came out in 2007 called Wired Shut, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture. Tarleton's book, although it came out a few years ago, is still quite timely because Tarleton's background, and we'll talk about this a bit more as we get into the discussion, is not as a lawyer, but rather he is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Cornell University. So he also has affiliations in the Department of Science and Technology Studies and Information Science. So he is not a lawyer per se, and we're allowed to have non-lawyers on the show. But of course, he writes about the law, particularly about copyright, and more specifically about digital rights management. The focus of Wired Shut, and the angle that we're going to be focusing on primarily on this show, is how technology is used to lock down our uses of technology themselves. In other words, digital rights management and broadcast flag and trusted systems and all of these relatively new terms go towards one of the basic foundational issues that we think about in technology when we think about how consumers and the public can use technology, which is the rights and abilities of the technology creators and the content providers to control our use of the technology itself. This is obviously a very hot topic. This is something that we focused on quite a bit on Hearsay Culture. But today we're going to focus on it more from a sociological and communications perspective. And Wired Shut takes a very detailed view of the sociological impacts of this technology and these uses or lack of uses of technology. A personal interest of mine, something that I write about, is how intellectual property impacts transparency in governmental operations. And while Tarleton doesn't write about that specific issue, he does write quite a bit about encryption. And encryption, of course, broadly the field of securing and holding confidential data by means of all types of technologies and ideas that go back to the dawn of time, is an area that ultimately and broadly focuses on how much information we can get our hands on, how much transparency exists versus how much information is controlled, or put it another way, how much information is kept secret. Today's discussion is going to be looking at some of these issues involving digital rights management and trusted systems and the broadcast flag, but we're also going to be discussing some of the issues that we are dealing with specifically today and that were not quite as high on the list in 2006 and 2007. So we'll be chatting a bit about network neutrality and the FCC and really having a broad discussion of these issues. I'm very excited to have Tarleton on, who is also a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society. So without any further introduction, Tarleton, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate the invitation.
I'm excited to have you here. Let's start off with a question I ask all of my guests, really, which is how you became interested in these issues. What was the genesis of writing a book like Wired Shut?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm not a lawyer and was not training to study the law when I was beginning to consider these issues. I was in a communication program as a graduate student at UCSD. San Diego, and you know, I was studying in a sort of broad sense how what we see as sort of the broad culture, the sort of the things that we encounter as public culture, how that is shaped and defined by the processes that produce it, whether that's commercial processes or industrial processes. And I was really interested at the time, as I was beginning to establish what my research area might be, in kind of emerging cultural practices and how they were connected to the internet and sort of online expression. I had this grand plan to write a dissertation about sampling as a cultural technique, and if I had pursued that one, I think I would have ended up, writing Lessig's third book instead of his first one. But I was going to interview Beck, and I was going to study how sampling happened across all these fields. And my very generous dissertation committee said, okay. And so then I said, well, what do I have to do next? And I began reading about sampling in hip-hop, and then I was encountering some of the copyright questions that hip-hop faced in the 80s and early 90s. And as I was familiarizing myself with that and had known about copyright and had been thinking very closely about sort of ideas of authorship, Napster was sued. And it was one of those sort of golden egg moments that you hope for in a dissertation moment, where it was painfully clear what I needed to be studying. It was not the thing that I thought I was studying. So that's when everything turned, and that's when I had to sort of give myself a layman's education in copyright law. But in my mind, it was a perfect moment or a perfect sort of example to think about these broader issues. And as you mentioned, I'm a communication scholar, so again, I'm looking at this, you know, relatively legal and economic and political controversy, but I'm trying to look at it from the vantage point of what we're doing here beyond deciding how copyright should apply in a digital context, beyond, you know, picking and choosing sort of economic winners and losers, is we're defining how culture is supposed to work. We're defining how we structure culture in this new environment. And we have these moments where that can happen, and I think coded inside of the debates about copyright and piracy and DRM and you know, business models, it is a discussion about what are the right relationships between people who produce information, people who need it, what are the right relationships between the people who create content and the people who create tools, what's the right relationship between individuals who need information and institutions, whether it's government or corporations, that are going to provide or regulate that information. So I love the copyright debates, and I love thinking about the collision of law and technology that, that digital rights management, DRM, offered. But it lets me play in the specific legal conversation, and it lets me speak back to these sort of very broad concerns that we have in the field of communication and the field of sociology.
The whenever I have a guest on that is not a lawyer but who is forced by hook or crook to write about law, I'm always curious to get their perspective on the state of the law itself. So, you know, coming at this from without formal legal training and not being a lawyer, what was the biggest challenge for you as an author in getting your head around copyright law?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a story about the difficulty, and I'll tell you a story about how it felt easy. So I was beginning to study this, and of course you're also a grad student and you haven't established yourself, you don't have a publication record. And I started to go to these conferences that were largely hosted at law schools, and some of the people who are still luminaries in this conversation were having these fascinating discussions. And I remember going to this conference and sitting around this very well-appointed meeting room. You didn't have those in communication, but the law schools looked great, and there were plugs in every seat, and the conversation was fascinating. At one point, someone was giving a presentation, and I wish I could do it verbatim, and I can't. This was several years ago. But they were giving this nice, serious point about copyright, and then they made a joke, and the joke was, well, that's true about Section 105, but not 107, 108, or 9. And the whole room burst into laughter, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And I realized that there was I had a lot to do to get inside that conversation, to sort of penetrate, knowing the law well enough, knowing the precedents well enough, knowing the sort of the philosophies well enough. That said, the way that it engineered for me was reading court decisions did not feel so different when they were good ones from reading scholarship, from reading literature. I remember very early on when I thought I was studying sampling, reading Justice Souter's decision in the Two Left Crew A Cuff Rose case, and it's beautifully written, and it's thoughtful, and it's fascinating, and I remember feeling like, this is scholarship, except they actually had to come to an answer at the end. I'm not always asked to do that, and being sort of impressed by that, and so I think that was the way in, is that in those moments, I could see that was scholarship, right? That was sociology. It was thinking about how we set the terms for who gets to provide and who gets to reuse does set the terms for speech, does set the terms for parody, creativity. And you know, just because it was in a language of this is a Supreme Court decision didn't take away that element. So that felt like a way in.
And I'll tell you, we are fortunate to have some many judges that I think write with a audience in mind, which helps not only non-lawyers but also lawyers in training actually learn the law, which leads to a question about the book and also a broader question about your work. Who do you have a particular audience in mind when you write a book like Wired Shut, and your work generally, beyond the obvious that, you're a communications professor or other communication scholars would be interested, but is there a broader or different audience that you're attempting to reach?
There is. So, I don't want to pretend that I'm the first one to try to do this. There are a lot of people who are trying to do this, but, so much of this discussion, especially early on, in the first part of the last decade, was happening, among legal scholars who were prepared to have it, and among a very particular kind of technologically savvy group, whether it was the Slashdot people or the Electronic Frontier Foundation people, who were really interested in the way some of these early decisions were going to have an impact and how ideas about copyright and ownership and offship were potentially changing. And I felt like I found the discussion fascinating. I could see how it linked to some of the broader questions about the structure of public discourse. So I guess in my mind, I was trying to balance a line, I hope the book does this, of joining that conversation and having it be sophisticated enough that it can join that conversation, that it also broadens the conversation to say, we've asked these kinds of questions before, not around digital technology, but around how owners, tool creators, and makers sort of arrange their resources. And the sense that this is mattering to everybody, not just the people who know to get on Slashdot and debate this, but anybody who's interested. And to me, if you're revealing how DVD players work to change how you experience film in a way that the VCR didn't or going to the theater didn't, or if you're telling them why the record industry is pushing so hard against file sharing, that to me was something that I wanted lots of people to encounter. So I also tried to make it something that was approachable, that was readable, and that raised those questions in a way that made sense to a lot of people. I don't know how well I it's a lot of balls to keep up in the air. And as I said, there are other people who are trying to do this and are doing this very effectively. I've also heard a number of the legal scholars that I now consider colleagues saying that this was part of their experience, too, of the last 10 years, is that they may have been debating copyright for 30 years, but for 20 of those, it was this very particular legal question that very particular businesses and very particular regulatory agencies care about. And suddenly this was on, the front page of the New York Times, and it was in the issues of Wired, and it was in Time Magazine, and it was on the radio, and it was something that everybody suddenly had heard about and had a stake in, and that's an education moment to me. It's like, well, let's put the best insights that we have about how these things work and shape the way we ask these questions for as many people as who would like to think about this as possible.
The author is Charlton Gillespie. The book is Wired Shut on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, with some previous guests, I've mentioned I grew up in a house where my mother is a jacket art designer. That's what she did as a living, as an artist. So I tend to look at jacket art and how jackets are designed probably more so than perhaps anyone that interviews authors. And I will note that I found the cover of the book quite clever. The cover of the hardcover edition shows a chain link fence and an angle, and then the closest image is of a USB cable creating part of the chain link fence, which I think you owe a debt of gratitude to whoever designed the book covers. I think they put a lot more thought into it than many of the others I've seen, and it leads me to the question with regard to the subtitle of the book, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture. So what do you mean by the shape of digital culture in this book?
Well, I'll say first, I'm glad you liked the cover. That was actually designed by a good friend of mine, Nat Sims, and we came up with the idea for it together. But
congratulations then. You have a future as a jacket art designer.
So the shape of digital culture, I think, was my attempt to put these very specific questions about copyright and piracy and DRM into this broader context. I think one of the things that's very powerful about how these conversations go is that when we're debating about whether Napster should exist or whether a crack of the encryption system should be illegal or whether we should pass a particular law like the DMCA, that there's a tendency, although it's quite clear that we're making momentous decisions, we're passing a law that's going to have consequences, and not just consequences for case X that's already come up, but case Y and case Z that are similar in the future, that the specifics of what is at issue at that moment tend to take precedence. And in addition to that, I think that those stakeholders who are interested in the results of those cases or controversies have a vested interest in narrowing the conversation, right? This is simply about whether people are stealing Britney Spears' music. This is simply about, you know, whether or not internet piracy is going to kill the movie business. And every attempt to sort of close the conversation to that, okay, you know, this is, the answer is obvious, right? If the question is, you're killing the movie industry, then you say, well, let's not do that. But the broader questions are much harder. And my sense was, there's another conversation going on over the last 15 years, which is, we are engaging in a very new and fascinating medium of information and communication. Not that it's going to radically revolutionize everything, but there's a lot of potential. And part of the ideas that I drew out of the sociological work were that, you know, these technologies, whether it's the internet or whether it's, you know, peer-to-peer networks or whether it's encryption in this context, can end up being a lot of things. But what we end up doing is we define them down to being certain kinds of things. And that process closes off other possibilities, maybe possibilities we could have explored. And in that moment where we said, wow, what's possible with digital culture? What's that frontier going to look like in all its sort of utopian and, you know, hyperbolic way? At the same time, we were saying, well, we better have this law in place because this kind of violation is problematic to these people. And I think you have to have those conversations together. You have to look at those specifics, but also say, wait a minute, are we picking and choosing something that's going to have a broader consequence for the whole public discourse that's going to shape the way we encounter information and the way we think of ourselves as we encounter information? It's a harder question to ask, but that's sort of where the book was pushing, is that this is a bigger question. To treat it as a narrow one is risky.
The focus, as we get into the broader discussion, is on initially on digital rights management. And I think for those listeners that aren't familiar with that terminology, what is digital rights management and how does it work from a layman's perspective?
Okay, well, happy to answer that question. So if the first part of the conversation was me caveating that I'm not a lawyer,
yeah.
The second part of the conversation is caveating that I'm not an engineer. So those who do know how DRM works can chuckle that this is truly the layman's version. But certainly in the context of the entertainment industry, digital rights management is an umbrella term that names a couple of different ways to technologically protect the information that you distribute out in the world. So the example I talk about a lot in the book is DVDs. So the content of the DVD, the film that you purchase, is not on the DVD in the way that it used to be on an LP, where it's just sort of in a line. They've used algorithms to take the digital information and to scramble it in a way that a regular user wouldn't be able to retrieve the film unless they had a way to decrypt that information. And the way to decrypt that information is built into your DVD player. So for your experience, if you're going to buy a DVD and play it, that encryption is meaningless, right? The film comes out, and you sit down, and you watch. But if you were interested in duplicating that information, transferring it to a different format, that data is in a form that, without the right key, is very difficult to manage. The key built into the device then makes you use that device, and the device can honor a set of rules. For instance, the DVD player doesn't have a record button. So if the information is encrypted, if it's been algorithmically distorted such that it doesn't read unless you have a key that converts it back to readable format, then you can build that key into a device that regulates as much as it does facilitate your use, like playing film.
The focus being DRM lends the obvious question. In 2007, when the book came out, what was the import of DRM before we get into what it means from a sociological perspective? And has that changed in the intervening couple of years?
Yeah, it certainly has. So I just recently wrote a little preface when MIT Press turned this into a paperback. And it starts by saying that about 3 weeks after I turned in the final draft of the book was when Steve Jobs made his big announcement that said, you know, we're going to start dropping DRM from Apple and iTunes. We partnered with EMI. And
right.
By the way, DRM is terrible and we should be rid of it. And it hasn't gone away by any means, but the music industry has stepped back a bit from its sort of DRM strategy. I think there was a period early on, and this is being part of the argument, where DRM sounded like a very appealing solution. The alternative seemed like suing customers, which wasn't going that well. It wasn't clear that had an impact. Trying to squeeze out peer-to-peer networks that were, international, mobile, hard to pin down, hard to sue. Or this idea of building the consumer materials, the DVDs you buy, the CDs, or the digital music, such that it could only work in this form. And there was a dream of kind of like a perfect leak-proof system where if the music was only released in this protected form and it never got out, then you wouldn't have peer-to-peer. You wouldn't have piracy because there'd never be a copy that you could make a copy of. I think that dream was naive or optimistic. That it was pretty clear to most of us pretty soon on that that was an impossible accomplishment. What I think it is more interesting for the industry is that it provides just enough protection that it stops a lot of people a lot of the time. And I've heard people call this curb-high protection, right? If you want to run off the road, you can do it. But the curb might stop some people if they didn't mean to or they kind of weren't intending to. So it's just enough of a barrier to guide most activity. I think what we're seeing now with DRM is not the what they were imagining in the first place, which was encrypt the CD, build the tool into the CD player, the DVD player. It's on a much more infrastructural level. I think Jonathan Zittrain has talked about this quite well, the way that sort of lock into a platform is being used in the mobile phone world, in the sort of digital music world. So there's all sorts of more diffuse forms where in order to encourage a user to draw content from a provider and then use it inside of a particular technical environment, use the third-party software, use that mobile phone but not other ones, use that telecommunication system but not other ones, you need to make the information or the communication locked such that that's the tool you need to use it with. So I think the DRM strategy is alive and well, although the imposition of DRM as it was first imagined, they've stepped back from that quite a bit in the last few years.
The without getting too far into the weeds, though, I do want to ask you. So given the timing of the book and weeks after its publication, the strategy changing, what was it? Were there events, or was it just a general belief at that point that enough is enough and DRM isn't getting the job done? In other words, what was there a particular impetus for the change such that DRM, as you note, is not as widely discussed as it was a few years ago?
Right. Well, in the book I talk about, one of the things about that I try to reveal about DRM, which seems like a technical solution, which seems clean and easy to impose and different than these sort of messy legal or social or economic interventions, is that, in fact, it requires all sorts of political and economic and legal and cultural foundations to be built. And I argued in the book, I sort of kept returning to two phrases, that in order for DRM to work, it didn't just have to work technically, it didn't have to just function, it needed political mobilization and cultural legitimation. Basically, it meant it needed institutions to agree that this was a system they would back, not only technology partners and content producers to say, yes, we're going to adopt this system, build it into their technology, agree to contracts, agree to arrangements, but also needing Congress, needing the FCC to sort of authorize these systems, say that violation of them is a criminal act, which is what the DMCA says, that they can be imposed and regulated. That would be the political mobilization that was necessary. The cultural legitimation is that you got to get consumers to sort of buy into this. And there's all sorts of ways in which DRM can kind of disappear underneath what looks like a system that you just play movies and it all works. But in fact, there was a tension to this strategy, just like there was a tension to the lawsuit strategy. And there was a real backlash to it. And I think that the first thrust of the DRM approach failed on both counts, right? It failed in certain ways to gather the right political and institutional backing, and it failed on a sort of cultural legitimation level. This idea of a sort of technical lock-in, which I think is just as much in the spirit of the DRM strategy, I don't see nearly as much sort of hesitation about that. Yes, people are jailbreaking iPhones, and that could be akin to
cracking the DVD encryption. But there's an awful lot of embrace of the way these systems have been built. There's a little argument in the book where I said, you know, the music industry had such difficulty trying to impose DRM, and the movie industry sort of built it and didn't have trouble until it got cracked. And I think one of the things they did differently was that the movie industry waited to release anything digital, the DVD, until they had encryption in it. So for consumers, they went from videotape to a DVD. And the advantages of the DVD were quite visible, right? The quality is better, the sound is better, you can skip, you can, you know. And so how this system worked was, on the whole, a positive thing, and it actually had this limitation in it, but it was buried. Whereas for the music industry, they already put CDs out, and all they were doing was trying to make them worse. And that was, you know, consumers hated that. And I think the fact that the iPhones and the, you know, that format have emerged with platform lock-in makes it harder for people to raise questions about that as a detriment. Not impossible, and we are seeing it, but it's so much wrapped in the appeal and the draw of the iPhone and the App Store and, you know, all the smartphone, the enthusiasm about the smartphone.
We are talking with Professor Charlton Gillespie of Cornell University, author of the book Wired Shut, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of ways you can do it. First, you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate the KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and you will get a very happy and very cogent response from our underwriting department. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU and to support the station in the new year. Charlton, let's turn to this issue of secrecy. And again, it's one that's a personal interest of mine, but I think your book, his take on it, is quite interesting. There seems to be, at least I've noticed it, there seems to be an increased discussion of what secrecy means in the intellectual property world. There seems to be, and I say increased in the last year or so, that there seem to be a bit more people thinking about transparency and secrecy and what it means culturally in technology. Your book focuses on technology secrecy more than most of the books I've read. And I'll ask you this broad question. What is secrecy, and how does it impact our use of technology?
That's a wonderful question. I think maybe the way to start for me is to say why it surprised me to think about encryption as being proposed as this intervention into the copyright world. So if you look at the long historical term of copyright controversies, you know, there are a set of issues that have been pressing for a very long time, the questions of who an author is and what creativity is and what makes something different enough. And those questions continue, and they persist in this environment and are being challenged in all sorts of ways by remixing and collage and what have you. But the addition of encryption as a sort of intervention, as a way of enforcing copyright relationships, was, I think, a relatively new element of this. And so it made me think, well, you know, I need to know more about encryption as a sort of historical phenomenon. And I found it really fascinating, just as kind of a way to think about how radical an intervention this is. When I thought about that encryption as a sort of historical phenomenon was a way for people to keep secrets from their enemies. So the classic idea is, you know, a messenger is passing through, you know, enemy territory and is carrying a message with them, and if they are captured, they don't want this message to fall in enemy hands, so they put it in a secret code that only the recipient would know. And the relationships built into that idea are about two trusted communicators in a world of people who would take advantage of their communication if they were to get it. And so when you think about that set of relationships in this context, the trusted communicators are the movie industry and your DVD player, and you're the enemy. And I thought that was a very interesting... Now, it's not meant to play that way, but I think to see it in that context raises the stakes for asking the question. Then I think about, okay, so one of the challenges, I think, for copyright law is that at its base, at its foundation, what it's trying to do is to map the relationships between creators of information, readers of information, and potential users of information, on the one hand, with the relationship between producers and consumers. So taking an information relationship and mapping onto it a commercial relationship. If you are the creator of the information, with copyright law, you get to be the owner of the information. And the property rules that go along with it will manage your relationship to the people that you're writing to or writing for. And when I teach this in again, non-law school courses, I try to push that question. This is the point at which we decided that it's okay and that it's worthwhile to make information a commodity. And there's all sorts of reasons why that is a terrific thing to do and is a powerful way to spread information and get it into the hands of a lot of people. That said, many, if not all, of the places where copyright runs into tension about creativity or about who has rights to use things are about where those relationships don't fit quite so well, where the push to make it a producer-consumer relationship undoes something that's supposed to be valuable about the creator-reader-user relationships. Now you map encryption onto it, and you've got this third relationship, which is sort of friends and enemies, confidants, and people who would take advantage of that. And I think that that layers another complexity onto what was already a sort of fraught set of roles. And that's why, you know, again, in the sort of broad sense, if we want to ask questions about what I call the shape of digital culture, the imperatives that we have that drove the creation and the philosophy of copyright that says we need to encourage learning, we need to encourage an informed democratic populace, we need to encourage ideas, we need to encourage science, and all of these things depend on and require the circulation of ideas, the discussion of ideas, the reuse of ideas, and that requires incentive but also flow, to then say the market is the best mechanism to accomplish that, is a devil's bargain, right? It embraces some problems while it also gets very far towards its goals. And then as we manage this third level that says we can enforce that by creating this third relationship, which is who has secrets and who has the right to access secrets, there are places, I think I hopefully point them in the book, where the very needs that we are imagining on a sort of democratic scale or a sort of public discourse scale don't exactly fit that relationship. I think there's a neater fit between the encryption relationship and the producer-consumer relationship, just as we don't expect to read someone's book until they've decided to release it. We understand that there's a desire for secrecy there, and copyright law has special standards for what happens when an unpublished work is being distributed. So we expect secrecy in the production of a commodity, but there are different impulses about the right to information. Those are places where I think we have to look very carefully.
The a popular phrase that you hear used when I think when people are talking about blogging and Facebook and these other social networking sites is the idea of the walled garden. And I think part of what you're focusing on is that concept of the walled garden, that there seems to be and this has also been written about, this increased enclosure movement, something that Jamie Boyle has written about recently with regard to the public domain. How concerned are you about the walled garden effect? And I'll ask you to define it as you choose. And how concerned are you ultimately about encroachment of the public domain in light of the increased interest in locking down a lot of these technologies?
Yeah, the sociologist impulse in me says there are always constraints. So, you know, someone who's editing Wikipedia or someone who's blogging can say, you know, this is the open form, and there's the big bad entertainment industry, and they have the closed form. But the open form has norms and arrangements and rules too. They're different and with different consequences. So, you know, I think any time we begin to engage in some form of public communication, we have to think about whether the ways in which we create things, the ways in which we distribute things, the tools we use to do it, whether those sort of practical concerns and the economic, you know, basis, is it an advertising basis, is it a pay basis, is it a volunteer basis, how do we manage quality, how do we manage, you know, things that we think are inappropriate, what kind of interventions are we willing to engage in, is there self-censorship, is there feedback, I mean, that's, you know, all of these mechanisms are designed to collectively produce something and not something else. And, you know, closed code and, you know, sort of commodity forms of film and music are one of those. Now, we can take those to task, and I think this is, you know, exactly what Jamie Boyle was doing very effectively with the enclosure argument, was to say that the strategy of that the entertainment industry has been taking over the last 15 years or longer is to say the best way for us to get all this great content to you is to give us the most property control, and marginalizing the kind of other imperatives that fair use represents, that sort of non-commercial use represents. And I find it really fascinating. I mean, that worries me. It worries me a great deal because I think that the innovation in culture, the sense of participation in culture, which I find very important, you know, does culture belong to us? Is it something that we can intervene in, or are we recipients of that? I think the sense of being a recipient of culture is quite encouraged by that economic relationship. Sit back, watch the movie that we show you, and enjoy it in a sort of consumer relationship, rather than what I'm handing you is a contribution to the public discussion, and we'd like to see what you make of it. That's not the offer that's being made by a Hollywood film. I think that's an important part of sort of cultural agency. So I do worry about that kind of overemphasis on the enclosure of content, the sort of regulation. And to me, that regulation is usually about protecting profits. It's usually about protecting, you know, an ability to distribute content in the way that is most profitable. And that isn't always the right question to ask. At the same time, you know, I think that we're always making choices, and those choices are always imperfect compromises, but they need to be thoughtful ones. They need to seriously consider the fact that every time we create something and put it online and have some economic relationship to it, we're making a decision about its sort of participatory value. How does it add to things? How does it teach? How does it inspire? And its economic value. How does it keep me in a position where I can keep producing that content? And that balance always has to be struck, but it's one that has to be struck thoughtfully. And that's where I would push for all of these forms.
We're talking with Professor Tarleton Gillespie of Cornell University, author of the book Wired Shut, Copyright in the Shape of Digital Culture, on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Tarleton, I think your last response gets to another point that you address right up front in the beginning of your book and that pervades your book, which is a challenge to the, you know, what I'll call, you know, a utopian theory of technology, which is that technology can solve all social ills. And you say up front that is generally a false premise, that technology alone can't solve these problems. And I do want to ask you, perhaps in a little bit more fine-grained way, while it's certainly understandable and I think a strong argument to say that technology will not solve corruption or public corruption and technology won't make people ipso facto hate each other less, is it also fair to say, however, that technology in and of itself, simply by virtue of its ability to connect people that otherwise wouldn't talk, could in fact address some of the more, or I'd say less significant, but perhaps better way to put it is less challenging social problems or more manageable social problems, like, for example, the idea that a search engine can help us avoid the groupthink, that searching and serendipity will allow you to actually think outside or contact or just have discussions with people that may not think the way you do. So I guess my long-winded question here boils down to, are there particular social problems or social issues that you think technology in and of itself can address and perhaps even solve?
Yeah, I certainly don't mean to suggest that technology has no impact here. And I think, you know, part of what the literature I'm drawing from in the realm of the sociology of technology has really struggled with this. The technology clearly has an impact, and that it probably doesn't have the impact that we often like to think that it has. So I would sort of have two responses. So one is that I think that we are encouraged to think of the technical as not social, when in fact that's an artificial separation. So someone designs these search engines, someone designs these tools, and they design them with intentions in mind, and they design them with a business plan in mind, and there's there are arrangements that get built into that. So our use of a search engine that might connect us to an idea that we wouldn't have encountered otherwise, that could be transformative to our particular process. But that came from somewhere, and I think that there's one of the things we don't think about very often is how the tool we encounter is shaped by those aims, those ideas of what it is we're doing. And so, in the moment where we think, Google has revolutionized how we find information, it has. So, of course. And, what has it brought with it? How has it asked us to rearrange how we approach information? What were the sort of assumptions about finding information that are built into that tool that are now implicit in the way we search? That may have changed us from what we did before, but also brings with it implicit sort of likelihoods. So if we can undercut the impact of groupthink, how are we also approaching something like Googlethink? That's a simple way of sort of trying to raise the questions of the arrangements that are implicit in that tool. The other side, and this is what I explore in the book more, is that these technologies, when they end up coming into prominence, coming into our practices, being taken up, never come alone. And I think that, that was the story I wanted, that surprised me really about DRM. I thought I was going to tell a story that said, let's contrast technical solutions to legal and economic and cultural solutions. What I found was, you can't tell the story about DRM without talking about passing new laws. You can't tell a story about DRM without talking about industries having to come into alignment that weren't as closely aligned as before. You can't talk about DRM without talking about the cultural norms and the work that was being done to try to set expectations and teach users to understand what they should be doing with these things and to fight against the kind of critiques and the kind of covert moves. And even if DRM disappears, even if that idea of encrypting non-sensitive information for the purposes of managing its commercial life and its sort of copyright roles, even if that vanishes, the things that we put in place to make DRM work will still persist. The DMCA will still be on the books, and the closeness between the content industry and the technology industry will persist. And those ideas about what copyright is for and how we're supposed to think about information will persist. So that's the other place where I would say the technical is never just the technical. But it's often proposed, because the idea that technology can solve problems is a very appealing one, a very seductive one. But I think what it does is it sort of just erases the fact that there's always a social element, there's always an economic element to those technical interventions.
Charlton, we have about 10 minutes left, and this is the time in the show where I start getting into the unfair questions, the questions that can't be answered fully in the time we have left. And I'll ask you this broad question as we think about where we are today in 2009. One of the big issues is network neutrality. So I'll ask you the broadest possible question here, which is, are you concerned about this issue? Is this an issue that you think is real? And if so, what do you think is the possible solution to it?
Well, I think that, again, as I mentioned in the beginning, the purpose of this book was not exclusively to intervene in the particular question about DRM. It had a very broad imperative, which was to say, we're in a moment, maybe we're always in a moment, but certainly in the early life of a technology, and I think we are still very much in the early life of the Internet in a broad historical sense. The decisions we make about how it works, how it's regulated, how it's legislated, what we expect from it, how people can make money on it, how people shouldn't. Those decisions have lasting consequences, not just because, Apple sets up a successful business and they get to be successful for a while, but that the idea behind a certain arrangement comes to be thought about as the Internet. So we don't just experience the Internet as a technical thing. We experience it already laden with a set of meanings, a set of assumptions, a set of ideas. And I think, one of the things about net neutrality as a question was certainly this idea that maybe what's powerful about this network is this kind of committed non-intervention in how data transfers across it, and particularly a non-commercial approach to how data is transferred. And I think that the idea that it's truly end-to-end, that it's truly neutral, is itself a myth. But I do think that the imperative that that represents, this idea that says, what if we commit to a network that doesn't pick who wins and loses, that the economics happen on the services that are provided on this network, but that if we began to tip the scales of that system in terms of what even gets through at a certain speed or with a certain guarantee, that we've changed what this thing could be, and I do believe quite strongly that kind of not just imposing a law or not just imposing a regulation or not, but the very idea of understanding what this network should be matters a great deal. And we've seen this in the history of communication technologies. So the idea of universal service in the telephone system, the idea of the postal network as a non-discriminatory system, I think we've always negotiated what are we willing to give up to commercial interests in order to make the system work and work powerfully and work to its greatest degree and innovate as well as we can. And what do we require of that system, even if it's not in the best economic interest of its participants, because it has to serve some greater good, right? Some public interest, some imperative. And I think this is one of those moments where we're having that debate. I think it's been brought up quite forcefully, even in these sort of powerfully seductive metaphorical terms about neutrality and evenness and transparency and what have you. I think it's one of those moments where it's better to have the discussion in as many venues as possible, so that we can highlight up against the clear claim about what is economically necessary for the telecommunication system a much vaguer but maybe very important sense of what's possible. And we're often facing that problem when we deal with legislation about it's quite clear what one side needs and the other side is sort of less formed. It's what could be. And that often slips because the imperatives of the existing players are quite clear and are powerfully stated. But how do we keep listening for the thing that we think we could achieve that we don't even know how important it is yet?
And that, and that last point, I think, in terms of where we are today versus when Wired Shut was published, is important, because obviously since Wired Shut was published, we faced a historic economic collapse, where the government suddenly now owns car companies and owns AIG, and where hundreds of billions of dollars are loaned to investment banks under circumstances which concern me greatly, but which boil down to taxpayers lending money to the financial sector in order to putatively and allegedly prevent total economic collapse and chaos. And that profound change ultimately, one would think and one would hope, at least I would hope, would cause us to rethink an idea that you've mentioned a few times in this discussion, which is that the market corrects our problems, and that the market ultimately will allocate resources in the most efficient manner and perhaps even for the greatest good. It would seem that idea, to the extent that it held sway in 2007, should be reconsidered in light of the changes that have occurred over the last 2 years. Is that phenomena or that fact, or however you characterize it, important in your thinking about DRM and locking down technology? In other words, the market dealing with these issues. Does it impact your analysis?
Well, this is good, sir. You've given me a chance to make caveat number three. So number one was I'm not a lawyer. Number two was I'm not an engineer. Number three is I'm not an economist.
There we go.
So, this is good. But I would say...
Well, I'm only one of the three things you mentioned.
I would love to think that the events of the last 18 months would make us seriously reconsider a dogmatic approach to kind of a free market solves all. I'm not optimistic that that's actually happening. And the opposite that I could imagine is that the industries that have received bailouts, that have received assistance from the government, very effectively came in and said, "We're going to collapse without you. We need you, and you've got to step in and do something." And this is shockingly familiar to the language that Jack Valenti and others, there's a chapter in the book where I look at the way Jack Valenti, just as an example, has sort of made the case against piracy, made the case needing stronger copyright laws. And nearly every one of his speeches, even though they were florid and stylized and you know, went in many directions, started with, this is one of the most important exports in the U.S. It's a huge, you know, multi-billion dollar industry. And that idea of you know, the content industry as it exists is an economic force that needs protection. I could see a flip side, which then says, you know, the calls for certain kinds of protection, whether that's stronger copyright laws, whether that's, you know, more anti-piracy enforcement, what have you, might have more purchase in a moment like this, because here's yet another industry that has, you know, is desperate for a savior, even though that desperation has predated the economic collapse. The flip side of that is that one of the things that I think has changed since 2007 that is also important for how the copyright issue is changing is that, you know, even in the point that I was looking at it, the sides on the debate were pitched. It was, you know, on the one side, the content industry and its technological partners who had the ear of the government and could go in and, you know, lobby FCC. And the other side was kind of this, like, scrappy collection of end users and remixers and pirates and, you know, digital activists. And what's changed is that Google and Apple don't want to play the game that that Disney wants to play. So now we have sort of powerful, you know, moneyed institutions on both sides. Maybe it's not even two sides anymore. It raises a different question, which is to say, you know, a lot of people look at that and say, great, well, you know, Google's the middle ground, Google's the compromise. But clearly, and we can see in the Google Book situation, it's another direction. It's another direction that makes all sorts of decisions and assumptions about how information should work and what the right relationship is between information distribution and commodity distribution. So now we have to ask sort of broader questions about all the arrangements that are emerging. This is kind of my new research that I'm calling the sort of politics of platforms. So what are all the ways in which these kind of intermediaries who don't sort of channel information to you like a Hollywood studio or a broadcast network, but offer, you know, the archive of all things, how are their economic and institutional relationships also shaping how we get information, what information is available to us, who gets to speak, and with what consequence?
And that leads us, really, since we're just about out of time here, Tarleton, to point out two things. And one thing I want to point out up front, which is, and I probably should have said more specifically, which is that your work is interdisciplinary in nature. And so I've forced you to make three caveats. And you've again proven that one doesn't have to be a lawyer to have good insights on hearsay culture.
No problem.
So,
I love caveats.
Yeah, so it works out well. You mentioned it, and I do want to take 30 seconds here to ask you. So you're up. Upcoming projects. I know that we can find your writing at tarletongillespie.org, but perhaps you could talk a little bit more about what you're working on now.
Oh, the briefest version of it, and this is just the beginning of kind of the next research question, came out again in part of looking at the book and saying, what was I really after? And I think the broader question that always drives me is, what structures culture? And copyright is just one piece of that, and the technological interventions are just one piece of that. So I'm trying to look, the first article looks at YouTube and thinks about how it has articulated itself as a platform and what that claim would like to propose about how it is neutral and open to all things. The flip of that question is, in what ways do the guidelines, the policies, the norms, how are all these things, if we take them into account together, shaping the discourse that we do see on YouTube and how we see it versus the discourse that we don't? I think, it's a great new terrain for thinking about really old questions about free speech, about public discourse. That you know, YouTube and Google and Flickr are setting terms for the discourse that happens within them, and it's different than the concerns we had about a network or a studio. But there are concerns nonetheless, and to try to make visible the ways that they intervene and claim non-intervention, that they pair user content with commercial content, but also present themselves as champions of the user, that's a new terrain for thinking about where there are implications for, again, the shape of digital culture, the character of public discourse.
Professor Charlton Gillespie, author of the book Wired Shut, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture. Charlton, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion, but I've enjoyed it, as I'm sure the listeners have as well. So thank you for taking the time today.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited today to mention a number of upcoming guests on the show. I'll do it very quickly since we're running short on time. Upcoming this quarter include Kazis Varnelis of Columbia University, author of Networked Publics, Professors Danielle Citron of the University of Maryland and Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall Law School discussing fusion centers. Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the forthcoming Googleization of Everything. Professor Bobby Qual of DePaul College of Law will be on discussing her new work. Greg Nogheim, senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, will be on. Laura DeNardis, the executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale, and author of Protocol Politics, the Globalization of Internet Governance. Professor Shubha Ghosh of the University of Wisconsin. Professor Manuel Castells of the University of Southern California, Annenberg, author of Communication Power, another luminary in the communications field, and I'm excited to have Professor Castells join us. Professor Chris Kelty of the University of California, L.A., author of Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software, and also upcoming next week, Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School and Oliver Day of Harvard Law School, Berkman Center author, co-authors of the article The Hacker's Aegis, Protecting Software Security Research Against Intellectual Property. As always, you have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture, other than listening to it the main way, which is live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also pick up the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can subscribe to all of the events at CIS. You can also listen to the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows as well as the schedule and so forth. And lastly, you can pick up the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening to the first show of the quarter. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.